Iowa's Medicaid system is scheduled to switch to private management in just 2 weeks. Democratic lawmakers want to stop that. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Mondays, we like to track issues at the Iowa State House. And this hour, I'm joined by IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell. We'll hear from an Iowa mother who has concerns about the transition. We'll also talk with lawmakers about efforts to stop the plans to privatize the state's Medicaid system. Also, we'll talk with the public information officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services. Do you have a stake in the privatization of Iowa's Medicaid? Do you have questions or concerns? Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we want to get an update on legislative action regarding Governor Branstad's decision to transfer Medicaid management to national for-profit companies. This is a huge switch. The state federal Medicaid health insurance program costs some $4 billion annually and serves some 560,000 Iowans, poor and disabled Iowans. Now, three Republicans in the Iowa Senate broke party lines last week when the Iowa Senate voted to terminate the privatization contracts of these managed care organizations. Iowa's Medicare is slated to switch to private management in just 2 weeks. And in just a moment, we'll talk with someone whose family is personally impacted by this change, and then also with legislators from both sides of the aisle. As on our Legislative Mondays always happens, Joyce Russell is joining me from the State House Law Library. How are you today, Joyce?
Good. Thanks, Ben.
So I just, in the briefest way, mentioned the vote last week, this bill that's come up in the Senate. Tell us what's going on in the legislature.
Well, the bill, sponsored by Democrats in the Senate, would negate the contracts with these three private providers or private firms that would take over the running of the Medicaid program. It passed the Senate, as you just said, with some Republican support. But we'll hear from a Republican lawmaker in the House about her views on it. But the Speaker of the Iowa House has made clear she is not interested in bringing a bill out that would almost certainly be vetoed by the governor.
Mm-hmm. And the Democrats know this. So I guess my question for you as our legislative correspondent is, what is the Democrats' aim here if they know that it won't pass muster in the House and the governor is sure not going to like it?
Well, I guess you can ask Senator Mathis there when we get to her. Okay. There is still some optimism that the federal government will not approve this. It's still pending approval by the federal government, even though it's set to go into effect on the 1st of March.
Joyce, we want to reach out to our listeners this hour because, as I noted, over half a million poor and disabled Iowans are being served by Medicaid. So we want to hear this hour if you are listening and have a stake in the privatization of Iowa's Medicaid. Are you going through the transition like our next guest? What questions do you have? 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Julie Heiger is with us, an Eastern Iowan who is a mother of three kids, and Medicaid enters the picture in her healthcare. Julie, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks, Ben.
Tell us about your family and where Medicaid enters the picture.
You bet. I'm the proud mom of three boys, and actually all three of my sons are on Medicaid. My oldest son is six, and he's adopted from the foster care system. And then I have twins who were born at 29 weeks. And for those of you that haven't been pregnant lately, 40 is gestational. So I just entered the third trimester. So they were little two-pounders. My oldest son is also on the children's mental health waiver. And then one of my sons was diagnosed with cerebral palsy a few weeks after being born and is on the brain injury waiver.
Mm-hmm. So all three of your kids are recipients in some way or another of Medicaid?
Correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Where are you in the transition to getting a new provider now that these managed care organizations are coming into the picture?
Yes, well, I received the packet back in Thanksgiving, and actually all three of my children were assigned to three separate different MCOs.
Wow.
I
bet you that was a surprise.
It was, because I was thinking, well, you know, at least they'll maybe try and get their ducks in a row and assign everyone in a family the same one. But no, I kept opening the packets, and there was another provider, and there was another provider, and there was another provider. So, but, you know, being the type of research educator that I am, I went full swing into researching, you know, what's the best for my children. And in each of the packets, we received a lovely, glossy, one-page, very nice, colorful, looked really happy of each of the MCOs, just, you know, saying, choose us, choose us. And but, of course, there really wasn't any information about what services they would provide or why I should choose them. And I actually had a lot of difficulty finding information about what services they would provide, if they would continue with the different services that my children have. So actually what I did is I started researching and basically found out a lot of what people who in other states are in these MCOs and what they had to say. And when I was reading the responses that people have left on websites about this is what this MCO is, my heart sank. It just, I didn't know what to do then, because all of them were saying, oh, they're for profit, the pay is low, my provider's no longer taking them. And I have children who have very different needs. So my child with cerebral palsy had significant speech delays. And it turns out that one of the MCOs will not cover speech for children unless it's meeting the criteria of that of an adult, which states that he has to have a stroke in order to receive services. And it's through the early intervention that my son has been able to make the progress. And I can't even believe where he would be had he not received those speech services. Mm-hmm. So needless to say, I felt like I was choosing which level of hell in Dante's Inferno to place my children in terms of choosing an MCO.
So it's not just that there is some degree of hassle in this transition to one of these three private companies. You think the end game, the product that you will get in terms of services, is going to be really deficient.
Yes, and I was very worried because my sons cannot be without their services. Like I said, had, you know, United was saying, oh, well, we won't cover speech if it's, you know, this. And my son receives speech twice a week. I have another son who receives behavioral therapy twice a week. His counselor is just now taking one MCO, and the other people in her office have actually dropped Medicaid altogether, saying, we don't want to deal with this hassle. So, you know, I'm a fairly educated person. I can work through the system. I can ask questions. But I worry about the people that don't have a voice and don't know how to use the resources. And it's just a scary thing to what's going on.
Julie, this is Joyce Russell. I have a question for you. It was a little unclear to me when you were talking about getting the information in the mail, three mm-hmm. different MCO. MCO is Managed Care Organization. And then you talked about glossy brochures advertising each one of them. So you've been assigned, each of your children has been assigned, but then you have the option to change. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. You had a few months to say, oh, this is who I want to choose. The one page little informational, I call it a brochure, it's just a one page paper, was in the packet I received in Thanksgiving, you know, during Thanksgiving. At the same time, that was in the same packet saying who my children were assigned to.
To end this, Julie Heiger, what are you looking at now in terms of your insurance now and what it will be, how you will manage in the future going forward?
Yes, well, actually, this scared me to death that I started, because I basically said, I can't do this. This isn't going to be possible. So I was able to apply for the HIP program, which is the health insurance premium payment. So Medicaid is currently able to pay for insurance I can get through my employer and pay that premium, which is, you know, it's through the University of Iowa, which is wonderful. And then they cover whatever Blue Cross Blue Shield doesn't. So I started that in January, but because of my fear of transitioning to the MCOs.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'm just hoping that's going to still be an option, because the fact if we have to go back to an MCO, or if the waivers, you know, say, oh, you need to have an MCO, I'm really fearful for my children's progress. And I've seen the progress. Like I say, I take a child to therapy every single day except Monday. So we have a lot of therapies. We have a lot of needs. And just not, you know,
okay.
Having those needs met would be scary.
Thank you for sharing with us, Julie Heiger, mother of three kids in eastern Iowa on Medicaid. And thank you for sharing some details of your life so we can better understand this transition. Joining Joyce as well now, two lawmakers at the State House Law Library. Representative Lisa Miller is with us, a Republican state representative.
Linda,
I'm sorry. Representative Miller, forgive me. Linda Miller.
It's okay.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Also with us, Senator Liz Mathis, a Democratic senator from Cedar Rapids. I'm fairly sure I got your first name right, Liz.
Thank you.
Welcome to the program. Let's start with you, Linda Miller. We just heard some grave concerns of Julie Heiger, a mother of three kids. What is your position on the implementation of this plan due to take place in a couple of weeks?
Well, I really think that Julie's process was a difficult one, but she does have a complicated set of issues where she had all of her children in different programs in the Medicaid system. But the thing that impressed me the most was the system actually worked, which was the HIP program, which is the health insurance program, where if you have access to your own private insurance for your children, the Medicaid program will actually pay the premiums on that insurance program, and they can go into your own program. So I think in actuality, and she could have chosen that at any point in time.
Isn't that because of her connection with the University of Iowa? Does everybody have access to this HIP?
Anybody who is employed. So if you have disabled children, you know, foster children, whatever, and you are employed and your employer has insurance, then the children are can be on that program.
And that will continue under privatization?
Correct.
But there are many – this is Liz Mathis. There are many families that don't have that. They're not able to be employed because they're caretakers of their children, and they don't qualify for HIP. So they're, you know, 560,000 people total on Medicaid and about 57,000 on waiver programs. And of those 57,000, those are the most complex cases.
And Senator Mathis, we've been tossing that term waiver around, or Julie did. So what are we talking about when we talk about the waiver?
A waiver is there's an elderly waiver. There's an ID waiver, so intellectual disability, a brain injury waiver, and a number of other things that you apply to get help. To get extra help for the complexity of a child or an adult's case. So it could be mental health. It could be a type of disability. I think of my neighbor who she works and her husband works, and despite their income, they still qualify for some occupational therapies for their son. So in their case, it's what their commercial insurance doesn't pick up, and it helps to fill in some of the gaps. For some families, it's all in. So take into consideration Senator Yoakum's daughter, who is Down syndrome. She's an adult. And so she receives services at home, and she goes to a dayhab, and she has some transportation costs built into that. And so, you know, she needs some help with her adult child. There are several physicians that Sarah is seeing. So it could be a neurologist. It could be an otolaryngologist. She has some issues with her breathing and her functioning, you know, of her swallowing. She's also part of a genetic malformation that is kind of rare, so she goes to a genetic counselor. She also sees a geriatric specialist, because Down syndrome adults are aging at a faster rate. So parents like that are going to have to choose when they get their MCO packet, and maybe they're assigned to one of those three. They're looking at the provider network, which means who's signed up, which physician is signed up for this, and they have to choose which is the most primary physician. Is it their primary care physician, or is it the neurologist, or who helps their child the most when we're talking about some of these complex cases, these waiver cases?
And so when we say she has a waiver, that means she has a special permission because her case is so complicated.
I'd say that's probably a simplified way of saying it, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so there's some concern about people with waivers do have this more complicated treatment regimen, and so they're concerned about getting that met.
And that would be in the ID waiver and maybe brain injury. So let's say a quadriplegic adult would be getting help moving from one place to another in their apartment or their home. It could be someone on the elderly waiver who is in poverty and who needs some help, wants to really stay at home, not go into long-term care, but they need some help getting to maybe an aging services activity or something like that.
Linda Miller, if I can jump in here, Representative Miller.
Yes.
What have
yes.
you been hearing from your constituents in the Bettendorf area? What concerns, like Julie's, or is everybody okay with this in your area?
Well, I think for the most part, people do recognize that Medicaid modernization, or the fact that we, under the current system, the old Medicaid system, the costs were unsustainable, and that's basically why 39 states have gone to some form of managed care organizations. In the old system, it's an entitlement. People go for, it's called fee for service, meaning if you go for a service, we pay the fee, the taxpayer pays the fee. You go for more service, you get more fees. And in the system, so I'm a registered nurse, my husband's a family practice physician, and I managed the office for 17 years. So the way you increase your income in any provider is you increase the number of services you deliver, you get paid more. So it's called fee for service for a reason. You get more fees for more service. Mm-hmm. It is not a system that you have any mark of outcome or sustainable. And right now, the growth is unsustainable in that fee for service model. Most places are going to a managed care environment where you can actually control the costs and control the quality of the care that you're receiving. So the patient gets the right care at the right time in the right setting for the mm-hmm. right cost. Well, that's the goal of
right,
the
but and these MCOs are for-profit entities, organizations. Now, assuming that they make a profit in delivering these medical services, if they make a profit in excess of their administrative costs, will the citizens of the state of Iowa ever know? Is there that in place? For instance, is the state asking them to reinvest these profits, much like it did with Wellmark before when it became a for-profit company?
I think as the contracts are actually structured, and you can go back and look at the reference for proposal, the profit margin built into these is somewhere between 1% and 1.5% by the time they get through with the navigational systems that we imposed on them. Mm-hmm. So when we wrote the RFP or ask for a request for proposal, it included the quality measurement parameters that these companies are responsible for. It's called a capitated system where we withhold a certain amount of money. And if they don't perform to the standards that we're asking for, they do not get the money that is withheld.
But will we know?
So there's an incentive to do better.
Will we know their bottom line? How much profit or, in another case, how much loss they have? Will we know that? Will they be transparent to you, lawmakers?
Well, you'll certainly know it within the contracts we have control over. Mm-hmm. These are national companies, you're right. But you don't have to reinvent the wheel as to what is quality in most measurement parameters. There's national quality standards, and we built those in. We've never had the ability to measure the quality in the old broken Medicaid system.
Let me go back a little bit. So I of course, I agree with Representative Miller on some points. However, there are contracts that are let right now that ask for quality measurements. So RFPs go out all the time, and DHS oversees some of those contracts, and measurements have to be met, or the contract isn't, the recipient doesn't get money from that contract. So there are already measurements there. Going back to fee for service, and so and Representative Miller is calling it old Medicaid for reasons. It is a Medicaid system. But it doesn't, the new way of looking at this, moving a patient along a continuum of care, doesn't always convert or translate to complex cases. So if you have a Down syndrome child or if you have a quadriplegic patient, how is that patient able to move along a continuum of care? So there's a population that we're very concerned about that if that isn't shown, that some services may drop off or that they may cut a service seeing no measurement or no performance. It's not unlike someone who might be on Medicare who has a fall, an elderly patient has a fall. They have a physical therapist come by, and there are so many visits that the physical therapist makes, and that patient has to show improvement. And then when they start to show improvement and the improvement is sustained, then physical therapy stops. But that doesn't happen with some of our complex cases, especially mental health cases, where we have chronically mentally ill who are cycling through, some of their mental health issues. I would like to focus a little bit on something that was said at the beginning.
Just a couple minutes, and I'd like to have Representative Miller be able to respond. If you can be brief, please, Senator Mathis.
Yes, well, people are saying that this is set to go into effect March 1st. I think if you read the CMS letter carefully, the federal government's letter carefully, they said that they would reevaluate on March 1st, and they have 16 readiness metrics that they're following. Among those, comprehensive communication plans and monitoring the capacity of the beneficiary call center, several metrics. And as of the last CMS call that we had, there's only one metric that had been fully involved and fully completed, and that was the number 15, the pharmacy metric. What they told us 2 weeks ago was that they had serious concerns about whether IME could pull this off, and they did say there is a difference between a plan and then how well are you executing that plan? And they did have serious concerns about it.
And Representative Miller, do you share those concerns about purely on the issue of readiness?
Well, CMS is the one that determines whether or not the Center for Medicaid Services, which is out of Kansas City for us, which is the federal government, which controls all of these processes. It's not the legislature that made this program. The federal government said, we need to save money in the Medicaid program. We need to do it in a thoughtful manner. And to do that, we're going to allow states flexibility and give them 1115 waiver, which is what we applied for. What I want to point out is in the old broken Medicaid system, which is a system of illness, we pay for people to be ill in that system. I want to go to a system of wellness where we actually incent the companies to make people healthier. That's where we're going, and I hope that it will work for most Iowans. We have 560,000 Iowans. One in five Iowans are in this program right now. And yes, there are 10% of them that have very complicated issues. But in Iowa, I know that we can solve these problems. We just work together to do them. And I hope that Senator Mathis will join me in making this work.
And what are you hearing about the likelihood of what the federal government is going to do? Do you know?
No, I have no idea. I'm not the person they consult on this. And I think that's a higher quotient than I have. Anyhow, but I do think it's supposed to be somewhere here in the next week.
In the last phone call we had with them, they were concerned about the WellCare, the judge's ruling, and trying to get notice out to the WellCare recipients so that they could change by this Wednesday. That's a serious concern they have as well.
Okay, we have to take a break, and I want to thank our lawmakers with us, Democratic Senator Liz Mathis of Cedar Rapids and Republican State Representative Linda Miller from Bettendorf. Thank you very much for your time. When we come back, Joyce Russell and I will be joined by the public information officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. It's our Legislative Monday where we like to look in on some of the issues that are being discussed and activity to do with these issues at our state legislature. And this hour, we were getting an update on the legislative action regarding Governor Branstad's decision to transfer Medicaid management to national for-profit companies. This is taking place in 2 weeks if it's going to stay on this timeline. Medicaid, a huge program, insurance covering, costing $4 billion annually, serving over 560,000 poor and disabled Iowans. Now, critics have complained that the implementation of this initiative has been fraught with some problems, expressed some fears that Medicaid recipients will be shortchanged for their health care needs. The governor's position that he says it will save as much as $51 million in the first 6 months and improve health care through better screenings and curbing the duplication of processes. And we'd like to reach out to you. Do you have a stake in the privatization of Iowa's Medicaid? Are you experiencing the transition to MCOs? 1-866-780-9100. We'd like to hear about your experience. Also hear your questions. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Joining Joyce and I, Amy McCoy is with us, Public Information Officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services. Amy McCoy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about what's happening right now. What is the activity and what is your role at the Iowa DHS in overseeing that activity?
Right. I'm the public information officer, so I really try to get as much information out to media and our member groups and organizations as possible. We also have a member services and provider services area that they really do the outreach on the ground, and that's where a lot of our activity has been focused in the last several weeks. We've had member meetings across the state in 11 cities. That's where members could come and get direct help with their enrollment. If they had questions, they wanted to know something about their paperwork, they could show up to those events. Supplementing that, we have our member services call center. We get many calls there every day, and members can ask their questions. We've had some pretty intense provider trainings over the past several weeks as well. That's where providers have been able to go and get their detailed questions answered. We've provided webinars, so we're really focused on the people that this is impacting the most.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hearing from these people, the impacted people? What sorts of problems, concerns are you hearing about most often?
Well, of course, this is a very big change for both our members and our providers, but it's also something that has happened in 39 other states that have some type of managed care. In Iowa, we've had some type of managed care for over two decades, so it's not entirely new to everyone in this state. But what we want to do is make sure, you heard earlier this hour, for our members that have the most complex needs, we really want to make sure that they're in the situation that they need to be in. For most of our members, they're going to get such great access and quality through this new system. It's going to be tracking their health and helping them become healthier. And then for those complex members, we want to make sure that we can make their care as stable as possible through this new system.
Amy, we're hearing concerns about the provider networks and not enough providers signing up, even though it's 2 weeks off. Are you concerned about that?
I'm not concerned about that because I see the numbers changing every day. When we look at the number of providers we have in Iowa, we have about 28,000 providers who are active in the past 12 months. We know that 90% of those have signed up with at least one MCO, 70% have signed up with two MCOs, and 60% have signed up with all three. These providers don't have to sign up with all three MCOs for us to still have a very robust network for our members. So this is a lot of movement when you consider that we've doubled the number of providers just since December who have signed up for this new system. We do know that we have some providers who really want to wait for that final word from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And when we get that final word, I think you'll see many of those remaining 10% of providers come onto the system.
And what's your read on how likely the federal government is going to approve this? We're 2 weeks out.
So we work with them almost on a daily basis to update them on the kinds of numbers that I've just told you, what our communications activities are. Someone had mentioned the list of 16 items that we've been working on. Most of those have been approved. So there's several that CMS is still monitoring. The network is one of those areas. And as I noted, more providers come on every day.
I thought I had understood Senator Mathis to say only one of those areas was approved.
Actually, the majority of them have been approved. Some are still in process, some small items and continuing to be monitored. But really, the bulk of those have changed over the past couple of months to a completed status.
Uh-huh. Amy McCoy.
Are they just going to give you a call on March 1st, or how's that going
to
work?
Well, we hope to hear from them as soon as possible. I think that's great for not only our dedicated staff who have put in a tremendous effort to make sure that this system is robust and has the access and quality that our members need, but also for our members too. We want to make sure that when we're communicating with them over the next several weeks with their member cards, other pieces of information, that we're giving them the most up-to-date information possible.
And we should point out that
the federal government is keeping a close eye on this, and they did already delay it once.
Yes.
They could do that again, I guess.
Absolutely. CMS is the one who's approving our waivers. And so we have 10 waivers that we're looking at needing approved, and they will be evaluating those still. But again, when we look at the scope of some of the concerns that CMS had in December, we've really addressed those concerns. Each day more providers sign on. So I'm very confident that we have the kind of network in place that can serve our Medicaid members. We want members to have access. So we, of course, are going very closely through the data that we're seeing to make sure that the MCOs have the right types of providers in the right places. And we can work on an individual basis with certain providers to make sure that they have all of the tools that they need so that there aren't any barriers to them contracting like this. Most of our providers have had arrangements where they've already contracted with private companies because Medicaid has already had managed care in place. We've had Meridian, Magellan through the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan. People have been able to choose Coventry. And then there were two private plans that offered Hawkeye as well. So most of our providers are familiar with this type of contracting arrangement.
If you just joined us, Amy McCoy is with us, Public Information Officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services, talking about the move to privatize the management of Medicaid in Iowa, affecting some 560,000 Iowans, poor and disabled Iowans. And if you have a question or a concern that perhaps Amy McCoy can help out with regarding this transition to privatized management, 1-866-780-9100. Before we do go to a call or two, Amy, perhaps you have a number that people, we certainly won't be able to serve, but a handful of people if we do in the next few minutes. Where can people call for help if they need it?
Absolutely. Our members can call Iowa Medicaid Member Services. That number is 800-338-8366. If they're in the Des Moines area, it's 256-4606. For our providers, they are welcome to call 800-338-7909.
Okay, let's go to a few calls. Brenda is with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Brenda. Are you a Medicaid recipient?
Yes, I am. Thank you. And I actually have a kind of a cost accounting background, and I guess I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to be able to decide, you know, which of the three to go with, and, you know, it's a little bit hard to predict some future medical things, but even the current ones, I guess I don't know that I'm seeing a real clear comparison on mm-hmm. things. I have contacted a number of people who provide service for me, and, you know, some of them, the larger institutions, tend to maybe be signed up with all of them, but it seems like some of even like the counseling type people are saying that they're feeling a bit overloaded with having to file a lot more paperwork with multiple providers compared to their past, where some of them are talking, they may not continue to provide service because of that.
Okay. I like your first question. I think that would be very useful for a lot of people, Brenda. You've got these three MCOs, United Healthcare, Amerigroup, and AmeriHealth. Amy McCoy, any advice there on how people go about evaluating, choosing, because you can change. You were assigned one, right? And you can change to another, right?
Right. Our members get a tentative assignment, but they can make a choice of any of the three MCOs. This is such an important question because what we need to remind our members of is the benefits through the Medicaid program stay the same. Through the contracts that we've set up with the managed care companies, they still have to offer the same types of benefits that the Medicaid program has always offered. So when members are looking at making a choice in this new system, what they're really looking at is which managed care company is my provider signing up with if I want to stay with my same provider. And then also, there's also value-added services that the managed care plans offer. These can be things like tobacco cessation. It can be weight loss programs, after-school programs. These are the types of value-added services that Medicaid was not able to offer and would probably never have been able to offer. So these are services that go above and beyond what the traditional Medicaid program could offer.
Mm-hmm. And what is how were people assigned to these things? Was it in some cases random or looked at the particulars of that person's situation?
It was a random assignment, and it was based on case number. You heard earlier a family that had different assignments, and that would be because some families may have had different case numbers. So we did the algorithm, the managed care plans, each got the same number of members tentatively assigned. Members make their choice from there.
Right.
They need to make a choice this week, by Wednesday of this week, for coverage beginning March 1, but they have until the middle of May to make a change for any reason whatsoever.
Right. But you will admit our first guest there had three kids being served by Medicaid and was given three different companies there. That doesn't inspire, I think, the woman thinking that she's being looked after. How you can't deal with three companies for three different children. That doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, that's why it's great that members can call in and make a change, and it's a very simple process to do that. And again, it is complex when you look at different cases, when you have families who have members who are on waivers, have different providers, may have had adoption, foster care involved. Those can all be different case numbers. But what we want to do is, when they call in, be as helpful as possible to get them all signed up with a health plan that meets their family's needs.
Mm-hmm. Jan is with us in Creston, coming to the end of our hour, but we have time for a few more calls. Jan, what is your concern, your question?
Yes, hello. I'm a legal guardian for a developmentally disabled woman who, former to my guardianship, was a ward of the state, and I have been her guardian for 37 years, so I'm very well aware of her multiple needs. And one of my questions has been I've been hoping to go to one of the meetings you said you've been holding throughout the state. But I'm in Creston. We're a regional hub for services and residents for developmentally disabled, and there has not been a meeting in our community. The closest meeting to us has been 2.5 hours away. And I was wondering if it's possible to still request a meeting. I know our state senator has done so. But tell me about the meetings that are to be helpful when the travel distance is so far.
Thank you, Jan.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. You can request more meetings. This is noted now, and I'll bring that back to our folks as well. We have a set of cities that we usually travel to for those meetings. It's certainly the larger hubs where people can come. We've also tried to make information available by webinar, too. And then, of course, member services is available through the 800 number for people to call in with their questions.
Amy, I'm hearing a sort of basic question, and that is, these are for-profit companies, mm-hmm. so they're going to make money. Why should we not assume that they're going to make money by denying services? I've heard people say that.
That's where our job comes in at the Department of Human Services, is making sure that we have really robust oversight. We've operated Iowa Medicaid through contracts for a number of years, so we have in place very stringent contract requirements and standards. We will have our oversight in place. We've created a new Bureau of Managed Care just for that purpose. We want our members to become healthier. That's the point of the whole program that we're moving toward. We had a fee-for-service program that did not focus on health outcomes. Now we've got the opportunity to work through national companies who have both the technology and the staffing that Iowa Medicaid doesn't have, and they're able to leverage that to help people get connected with a primary care provider, make sure that they're not getting the same test at two different doctors. The kinds of things that can really make this program more sustainable over the long term without ever having to cut the services that our members need.
Well, you mentioned that these are national companies, they have experience, but there's also been reports of really what could even be called bad apples among this group, that they've been cited for various violations. How do you answer people's concerns about that, about these particular companies and the background, the history that they have?
To that, I say we are very focused on making sure that our members get what they need and having the kind of oversight that Iowans expect. We have been a leader in healthcare in Iowa for some time. We would anticipate to be a leader in this area of making sure that these health plans follow through with all of the contract requirements that we've put in place. These are really important. We are going to listen to our legislators about oversight. We are going to listen to our members and our providers about oversight. But we really do have many years of experience with this. We had a behavioral health program in place for all Medicaid members who used behavioral health. And we had the job of oversight for that program for many years now.
Do you think that the other states where they have these problems, that the other states did not provide good oversight?
I think everybody can have a bad apple here and there in the bunch. I think for us, we have to work really hard on what our system will be in Iowa. Just like we got together and worked on the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan in a bipartisan way, we hope we can come together and really work on this program and making sure that it meets the needs of Iowans and that there are the access and health outcomes that we want for our members.
But there's some indication that some of these are bad apples.
Well, again, this is where we come in. We had a very robust request for proposals process. We evaluated those proposals, very, you know, in-depth contracts that we have with these companies. And if they don't do something the right way, we have a number of repercussions that fall upon these companies, including that they aren't able to make that same profit margin, that if they are to meet all of our Medicaid members' needs, they're able to earn that extra.
And when you find out if something is gone awry, is that through – do you have audits that you regularly will be conducting on these companies, or does that come exclusively from answering complaints from Iowans?
There are many, many levels of oversight with this new system, including outcome measures. And we are going to have a dashboard that we're going to be posting at our website. We're going to be bringing to monthly meetings with members, the public. We want people to see how this program is achieving. That helps us stay on top of it, and it helps these companies know what we expect for access and quality.
Okay, let's go to a couple more calls if we can get them in before the end of the hour. If you've just joined us, Amy McCoy is with us, Public Information Officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services, and been talking about the switch to private management of Medicaid. Lindsay is with us in Des Moines. Lindsay, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a guardian for three individuals who receive a variety of level of services, from institutional care to home and community-based waiver services, and I do see that there could be some benefit from switching to this system. My real big question has been around the messaging and the communication. Amy has talked about the ability to call into member services, and that's a very easy process, and that has not been consistent with my experience or several other guardians in my social network who are either family members or volunteer guardians. And so I wonder kind of how they're planning on addressing those continued issues where you call in and nobody's able to answer your question, you call in again and you get a different answer.
You're calling into the DHS or to the managed care organization?
To member services with Iowa Medicaid.
Okay. Can you answer that, please, Amy?
Yeah, Lindsay, I hear you saying guardianship in your question, so I wonder if it's surrounding the issue of guardianship and not having the releases that you need to have to be able to get those answers. Is that part of the issue that you're having?
No, huh?
Okay. Well, my apologies that you aren't getting your questions answered. I'm happy to take your name and number offline. It sounds like you have some members who have some very complex needs, and we want to make sure that they get the services that they need. They should also have case managers for those members, and you should be receiving information about that. Their current case managers are able to start working with their new case managers as well, because we want to have that continuity of care for our members going forward.
And what's the process in place when that is disconnected? That's not happening.
Well, with case managers, our members can keep their current case manager for 6 months because, again, we want them to be able to get into this new process, have people that they know and depend on. If their current case manager isn't going to participate through the new managed care system, or if they've begun working for one of the managed care companies, the members can arrange to follow that case manager, or we'll get them someone new that knows how to meet their needs as well.
Thank you, Lindsay, calling from Des Moines.
And Amy, I would like to add, there have been conflicting reports on how many other states are doing this. I think when the program was announced, it was a large number, more than 25, I believe, of other states who are doing this. Critics of the program say that there are only 4 states that are completely privatizing their Medicaid program. Others have parts of their program privatized, as Iowa already does, as you've pointed out. So can you clear up that discrepancy?
And I'm sorry, I don't have an exact number on how many states have done their long-term services and supports population, or maybe parts of that population. What we know is here in Iowa, we have about 50,000 long-term services and supports members. Those would be our members with the most complex needs, and those are members that we're doing extra outreach to make sure that we are meeting those needs, including our about 25,000 members who are on our waiver program. The number of those waivers is not going to be changing. We're going to be keeping the waivers at about the same level that we have right now. So really, when we look at managed care, again, like you noted, this is not new for us. We have had managed care in place for a several decades, and we want to make sure that our members are getting what they need, and we're going to be tracking especially those long-term services and supports members. So if their level of care were to change under their new health plan, we're going to be looking at each individual case. We have standardized assessments to look at what people's needs are so that we're looking at everyone kind of through the same angle so that people are measured the same way in setting up their services. That's something that we've lacked in the current system. So you may have people that get a tremendous amount of services because they had a provider.
Okay, we have to leave it for this hour. Amy McCoy, Public Information Officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services. Thank you, Amy, for coming in.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, as always, Joyce, for partnering with me on this legislative day, when we'll talk again next Monday.
Okay.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk with University of Iowa astrophysicist Phil Carrot about the impact of the discovery of gravitational waves last week. Coming up tomorrow, River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.